You're listening to a Radio 191 FM podcast.
You're tuned into R1 News at 1. Every weekday from 1 till 2 p.m., our dedicated news team brings you the hard-hitting stories, interviews, and culture pieces from across Aotearoa Dunedin.
Good morning. This is Radio 1. Good afternoon. This is Radio 1 News. It's Wednesday, 2nd of October. First, we'll have this week's bulletin, and then we'll have an interview with Dr. Leon Goldsmith from the Politics Department, University of Otago, on the ongoing conflict between Israel and Hezbollah, context within the Middle East, and what these tensions could mean going forward. Afterwards, we'll have local produce with Jordan Irvine and Jemima Lorimer. But first, Attitude by the Flaxies.
Here are the R1 News at 1 headlines.
This is the R1 News Bulletin for Wednesday, 2nd October, and I'm Tristan Serrano. In international news, Israel says it has bombed Houthi targets in Yemen on Sunday, expanding its confrontation with Iran's allies in the region after killing the Hezbollah leader Sayed Hassan Nasrallah on Friday in an escalating conflict in Lebanon, reported by RNZ. The airstrikes on Yemen's port of Hodeidah were in response to Houthi missile attacks on Israel in recent days, Israel said, amid fears that Middle East fighting could spin out of control and draw in Iran and Israel's main ally, the United States. The Houthi-run health ministry said 4 people had been killed and 29 were wounded in the Israeli strikes on Yemen. The Israeli military said, in a statement, that dozens of aircraft, including fighter jets, attacked power plants and a seaport at the Ras Isa and Hodeidah ports. The strikes caused power outages in most parts of the port city of Hodeidah, residents said. The strikes took place as Israel attacked more targets in Lebanon, where its intensifying bombardment over 2 weeks has killed a string of top Hezbollah leaders and driven hundreds of thousands of people from their homes. Israeli drones hovered over Beirut overnight, and for much of Sunday, with a loud blast of new airstrikes echoing around the Lebanese capital. Hezbollah and Israel have been trading fire across the border since the start of the war in Gaza, which was triggered by the October 7 attack by Hamas militants. Yemen's Houthis have launched sporadic attacks on Israel throughout that time and disrupted Red Sea shipping. Nasrallah's death dealt a particularly significant blow to the group, which he led for 32 years, and was followed by new Hezbollah rocket fire on Israel, while Iran said his death would be avenged. In student news, a reminder that voting for the 2025 OUSA exec is open. Head to voting.ousa.org.nz to cast your vote. You have until 4 p.m. on Thursday tomorrow to vote. This has been the R1 News Bulletin for Wednesday, 2nd October. Today's bulletin was written and read to you by Tristan Serrano. And stay tuned for the interview with Dr. Leon Goldsmith and local produce with Jordan Irvine.
Those were the headlines for today on R1 News at 1. Catch up on previous R1 News wherever you get your podcasts or head to r1.co.nz/news.
Welcome back to Radio 1. We now have an interview with Dr. Leon Goldsmith. Dr. Goldsmith is a lecturer, supervisor, and researcher from the Politics Department at the University of Otago. His area is Middle Eastern and comparative politics, and his research interests include pedagogy of the Middle East and concepts of tyranny, autocracy, and authoritarianism. He joins the R1 News to talk about the ongoing conflict between Israel and Hezbollah and what that means for the wider Middle East. Kia ora, Dr. Leon Goldsmith. This is Radio 1 News. We welcome you here today to talk about some political, what's going on in the Middle East. But how are you today first?
Alhamdulillah, everything is okay. Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for being here. From the perspective of someone who has extensively studied politics, I would like to ask what your insights are concerning what is happening between Israel and Lebanon, and now, recently, Yemen. What major parties are involved, and what could it mean for those countries?
Yeah, there could be a whole lecture series on this question. And it's interesting, you know, because when you get media requests or people are asking, so what's going on between Israel and Palestine, or between Israel, then it shifts the next day, what's going on between Israel and Lebanon, and then this morning was like, what's going on between Israel and Iran? It's almost like we want to kind of look at things in isolation, and I think this is part of the problem. Like, we think that there's some kind of way that we can focus in on a specific issue in terms of its dynamics. But I think what we need to do is, it's really hard to get our head around, but we need to look at the bigger picture of what's going on, and everything is a lot of different forces, a lot of different actors are interacting, and it's a complex environment. It's a very insecure environment in terms of, you know, the Israeli have this innate sense of insecurity, which causes atrocious behavior in terms of the way that they try to preserve their security. And then we have regional autocrats who have no real institutional or social legitimacy, so they're basically insecure innately as well in terms of their position and their fear of their own population. So you have these kind of different discourses which underpin this kind of ontological security mechanism of different actors in the region. So for the Israeli and whoever's trying to control power in Israel, it's the discourse of security. For Iran and its proxies or its allies, the proxies is not really the right word, because they coordinate, but they don't necessarily take orders all the time directly from Tehran. That's also, it's a discourse of resistance. And so the perpetuation of those discourses on both sides is what keeps them politically alive, so to speak. And so within that, you have ordinary Palestinians, ordinary Lebanese, ordinary Israelis, who, of course, is a very diverse population in itself. They're the ones who basically are left out of that calculation. So what's going on? It depends who you look at, who you are, whose perspective you're trying to interpret. So for the Israeli state, which is basically almost at war with itself in terms of different forces competing for what is Israel, what is it going to be, they look at the region and they say, well, we're up against an alliance of forces that wants to destroy us. So one of the earliest speeches by Ayatollah Khomeini in 79 was that the Zionist, whatever it was, has to be erased from the page of history. So that was part of this early establishment of a discourse. And at the same time, the Israelis, in their sense of security and insecurity discourse, basically absorbed that, literally, and have basically fed on that. So you've had this broad struggle between Israel and sort of Iran ever since the late 1970s all the way up until today. So what we're seeing today is the continuation of a kind of like a deadly game between the so-called resistance axis and Israel's kind of so-called security kind of apparatus. So it's, but what's happening right now is what would normally have happened by now, is that the Israelis and the Iranians would sort of, in whatever theater they were competing in, would have gone towards a pause, negotiations, concessions, whatever, maintain the status quo and then carry on. But Netanyahu is changing the rules of the game. He's changing this situation in terms of his personal insecurity. He's becoming much like the autocratic leaders around the region. He has to play certain games in order to maintain his position as Prime Minister of Israel, which he's had on and off since 95, 96. And the way he's changing the game is he's not stopping at the appropriate time. He wants to basically go on, and he actually wants to win a war against the resistance axis, taking it all the way to Iran if he has to. So the flip side of that is the Iranians, who have used Hezbollah, Hamas, and lately the Houthis as kind of like their buffer zones or their insurance policies against Israel directly attacking them. They don't see much alternative than trying to rush towards this nuclear weapon. I see that this is probably what's happening in Tehran right now. We need to basically do whatever we have to do, enrich the uranium, work with the Russians, work with the North Koreans, whatever, Chinese, to get a nuclear weapon in place. And this is not for geopolitical reasons. This is for the ontological security of the Iranian regime, which it for now feels an existential threat.
You mentioned that you could talk about this in a lecture all day, you know.
I'm sorry.
And that's fine. Actually, that segues into my next question. As a professor in a university, how would you contextualize the current political atmosphere that is brewing in the Middle East in a classroom?
Well, you know, the thing is, you can't, like I just did to you, you can't bombard students with highly complex, deep. You have to build it up step by step, or khutwa khutwa, as they say in the Middle East. So you start with basic principles in terms of, like, who are the, what is the different identities, what are the different interests, and how these actually are not homogeneous or singular, they overlap. So they have to start actually trying to unlearn the Middle East in terms of whatever they think it is about these kind of entrenched religious or geopolitical divisions. It's not that. I mean, I try and say we need to cut across it like a layer cake, where basically these kind of horizontal fault lines are actually leading us away from the real struggle, which is the struggle between ordinary people, progressives, and people who actually want to actually change the way that politics works in the Middle East. You have tyrants who want to basically, who have found themselves in that position and they have no way to climb back down. So they have to basically, as Winston Churchill said, if you're going to ride around on the tiger, you have to make sure you don't fall off. So the logic of the autocrats, and this is increasingly the logic of Netanyahu. So, and then you have messianics who genuinely believe that they're doing God's work. And whatever, whether it's Islamic State or Hamas or religious Zionists in the West Bank. And it's the dangerous combination is when the tyrants start steering around the messianics as a way to instrumentalize. So you have to try to break up the existing ways. And then I basically, once that they confused enough to know that what they thought they knew is not necessarily the way it is, I have a strategy of just throwing them into the deep end. So we have these, because of technology these days, the way pedagogical tools that we have, I get students to basically go onto live meetings, scenarios. Like, we have a diplomacy scenario starting this week with students who we're connected to in the Middle East, and talking about these issues and getting to see different perspectives that are not the standard perspectives in the literature. These are personal perspectives from people who are living experiences. So familiarizing them, and that's all we can do, is give them tools to be able to at least try to understand their pre-existing assumptions. And then, you know, the university is too short. I mean, to actually, nobody, I think we need to actually destroy and annihilate the idea of the omnipotent expert on the Middle East, because no one is that person. It's kind of a Western trope that's built up over many years, that the Middle East is some kind of exclusive cultural zone that requires cultural interpreters to be able to tell us what it means. No, I think we need to actually break that whole stereotype down. So those are the types of things that I try to give tools to the students to.
I think being asked to unlearn, like, a subject on something, and then being taught or given the tools to relearn it, gives a brand new perspective and is able to change minds, really. And I think that's really important, especially in a lecture environment where you're there to learn, and you're not really, as a student, it can be pretty easy to go into a lecture with predetermined thoughts on the subject. And that's, you know, that's my personal experience. But when you go in there, lecturer tells you something brand new, or, you know, disproves something that you've thought of, and you get to re-experience what you had thought of before, sort of like that kind of thing. I think that's really cool. So Next question. What do the wider impacts of this conflict between Israel and Lebanon mean for the surrounding regions, such as Iraq, Syria, or Iran?
So first of all, just, you know, on the basis of what we just talked about, I think that we probably shouldn't, I wouldn't define it as a war between Israel and Lebanon. I think that the fault lines are different. So Lebanon is basically has been a fractured mosaic for some time. It's made up of different communities with different interests. A lot of the communities in Israel have been increasingly resentful of Hezbollah's got an arrogant position within Lebanon, and the way that it's kind of came in, they are Lebanese, but they increasingly have a separate interest from the national interest. So it's a war really between Israel and the resistance axis writ large, which includes Hezbollah, which is currently occupying southern Lebanon and controlling southern Lebanon and to a large degree the rest of the Lebanese state. So because this is already a regional struggle, so part one was the first initial attack against those communities in southern Israel. And at that moment, Israel, which has basically got the most right-wing government it's ever had, and they've had some pretty right-wing governments, and they're moving increasingly towards the right further, decided that this game that we've been playing with Iran and its allies, including Syria and Hamas, and later the Houthis and some militias in Iraq, and Hezbollah, of course, is their trump card, that they were going to play this game differently. They decided almost immediately after October 7 that they were not going to have this kind of managed security situation, which whereby what they planned to do was to basically try to degrade Hamas, and the collateral damage of that, as we've all seen, has been basically whitewashed. For a lot of Israelis, they don't see the same pictures, the same images that other people see, or they choose not to. But then the idea was always to pivot. Articles I wrote earlier in interviews, I talked that they will, as soon as they feel like they've got Gaza situation under control, they will pivot to Lebanon and try to basically push Hezbollah, at least in terms of like Resolution 1701, which was the last deal that they made in 2006 with the last war, to push Hezbollah at least back north of the Litani River and create a buffer zone, which is patrolled by the Lebanese army, which is the only non-sectarian force in Lebanon that has any sort of like national identity, who has monthly meetings with the Israeli IDF, the Lebanese army. So it's quite interesting, but Hezbollah basically is more powerful than the Lebanese army. So they actually, so what will happen in terms of regional escalation is that Iran is increasingly being put into a position where it's being attacked everywhere, and its assets are being attacked everywhere, including in northwest Yemen, and now in Lebanon, already in Gaza, in the West Bank. It's a different situation. We probably don't have time to go into the complexities of that, because the proxies have different backers and so forth in the West Bank. So Syria is a country that could come into the picture. So obviously Syria's Bashar al-Assad has been licking his wounds from a decade-long struggle against an internal rebellion against his, because he's one of the ones that fell off the tiger. Like, his legitimacy got to the point where people couldn't tolerate him anymore. But Iran was not prepared to let his regime collapse, and neither was Putin, for various reasons. But I think we may see Syria increasingly come into the equation. There's a lot of Iranian militia there already. The Golan Heights hasn't been a conflict zone since 73, but this could be the next theater in terms of the spreading of this conflict. We've had rumors of mobilization of different, especially Shia militia, which are loyal to Iran in Syria. So what the Israelis see is a multi-theater conflict, which they think they can win. But they only think that they can win because they think that the Americans are going to have their back, and Biden's been giving them that messaging all the way along. So this is something that's driving us towards this wider conflict as well. I mean, if the US took a different posture, then I don't think Netanyahu would be brave enough to basically launch this region-wide war against. And the other factor, which is the Arab states, the Arab autocracies, and why are they so quiet? We're not hearing anything from them. Why aren't they joining the struggle against Israel? That's a very complex issue, but essentially what it is that the Arab autocracies basically say one thing and they do another. They're actually been quite behind the scenes, partial towards coordinating with Israel for a long time. Syria is the only exception to that, and that's why they claim to be part of the resistance axis, as they crush their own people at the same time. But what happened was the Abraham Accords in 2020 pushed the Arab states into a situation where they were coming out into the open in terms of their relations with Israel, and this was unacceptable to Iran and its allies, and it's kind of reveal the contradictions in terms of all these relations in the Middle East.
So following up from that, you said, you know, Israel sees all these conflicts and they believe, you know, they can win. So I wanted to ask your opinion on whether Israel is able to fight on these multiple fronts. And would this lead to allies of Israel like the U.S. to interfere?
Yeah, so I'm not sure. So I think they've been planning. I mean, for the first time, I went to Israel-Palestine in 2023. I hadn't been before because it would cause me problems in my access to other Arab countries. But so I was very fortunate to go there on a workshop for Tel Aviv University to get a closer sense of their insight. And on the last day of that workshop, which involved Middle East academics from different parts of the world, it was very interesting who they chose to invite. Kurdish, Ethiopian, Tigray. Anyway, on the last day of that workshop, they did this scenario, like the sort of thing I would do with my students. Well, basically, it was a live scenario. They made me to be the leader of the opposition, Yair Lapid. And what was happening was a multi-theater conflict, which was spiraling from Gaza to the West Bank to southern Lebanon and beyond. And they have had this in their mind for a long time and have been planning basically what do they do about that. I think Netanyahu naively and arrogantly believes that if he can crush the Iran-backed resistance, and I think he believes he can do it. I think they've shown that they can strike inside Iran, as they did with the assassination against Ismail Haniyeh and so forth, that they have a qualitative edge over the Iranians, that Iranians have a lot of missiles, a lot of rockets, a lot of drones. They don't have the nuclear capacity yet that we know of. I think that Israel dangerously believes it can beat Iran and its proxies, especially if the US has its back, and I think that's probably the case. But what they're not taking into account is the fact that they think, and this is what Netanyahu held up those two maps, and you may have seen in his UN speech, and he showed two distinct, very simplistic, reductionist images of how he sees the Middle East, that if he can just defeat those countries or the leadership of those countries, everything will fall back into place and Israel will be able to make peace with the Arab autocrats in the Gulf. But what he doesn't take into account, that everything that they do is pushing them further away from any kind of acceptance now or in the future by the wider Arab and Muslim or even the Western opinion. So he's destroying everything that they want to achieve, and so it could push things to the brink in terms of that layer cake I talked about before, like ordinary people and where they sit within this, because they're not part of this struggle. They're being basically kept out of it, but they care deeply about the values that they and Israel needs to realize that. But unfortunately, they're a little bit like the West, in that they don't believe the Arabs are capable of democracy. They don't believe that they're capable of a participatory system. This is why we didn't know how to act in the Arab Spring. We were quite relieved when they just reverted back to what we think is normal. So the Israelis have a similar unfortunate mentality as most of the world about the nature of the Middle East, and that's why it's so important for students to get to know something about the Middle East at the grassroots level. Like,
What would it mean for the world if the fighting in the Middle East drew out the U.S.? Could it escalate any further?
Definitely. Definitely. So I think this is what Netanyahu's been trying to do. He's been trying to provoke Iran into a direct confrontation, not just via these proxy theatres, which will draw on the U.S. Well, if the U.S., as Biden has said several times, that they will not let Israel, you know, be defeated. So if there's a sense that that could happen, then the U.S. could come in. It's hard to predict the laws of unintended consequences, but if the U.S. comes in and strikes Iran alongside Israel. So Israel's been planning to strike Iran since the mid-2000s, since they first suspected that they were developing nuclear capacity. They bombed a nuclear installation in Syria in 2007. Anywhere they feel like this is their existentialism. So Iran is increasingly working together with Russia in terms of technology transfer, and because Russia needs, they're supplying them with material like rockets and missiles and things for its war in Ukraine. Russia could very easily equip the Iranians with a nuclear weapon. I don't think Russia wants to see Iran. They're not natural allies, but I don't think they want to see them defeated and the U.S. kind of topple that regime along with the Israelis. So I think Russia might complicate that situation, and I think China is also very keen not to allow a collapse of a fellow autocratic regime, which is part of their sort of it's a new book that I've just been reading, Autocracy Inc. by Anne Applebaum. She's interesting. I'm working my way through it, but I think there is something in that argument that these autocratic states feel that they have a common interest in terms of not allowing U.S. power to project into any of their interests.
Final question. What are your thoughts on how the media have reported the conflict in that region?
You know, like I was saying at the start, like, we focus on what's happening now, like the recent kind of flare-up, and then without really taking a step back, we're just sort of riding the crest of a news cycle. And I think that the polemicization of this is increasingly problematic. I think that there's a huge difference between people who just watch Al Jazeera and people who just watch CNN and BBC. It's exacerbating differences of opinion even in Western countries and around the world. I think that we have to understand that Al Jazeera is very interesting. This is a new phenomenon. This is an extremely powerful news source, which is extremely influential, and it's not necessarily factually wrong, but the decisions they make about how to frame issues in terms of what they focus on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, Qatar is an unaccountable autocracy as well. They're involved in Horn of Africa. There's huge famine and civil war and strife in those countries. They've been involved in North Africa and Libya, Tunisia as well, along with their competitors, the UAE, and a kind of neo-colonialism that these... So we have to look at what is behind the sources of information. So we just have to be very cautious. So Al Thani ruling family is one of the most powerful families on the planet, and they basically control Al Jazeera. We need to democratize the media, and we need to be very critical and very cautious. We need to, Israelis see a version of the media. So if you just read the Jerusalem Post, you would think that everyone is a terrorist and this is the security narrative. But the liberal press in Israel Haaretz is also mixed, so there are different things. We just have to be looking, and the German media, for example, DW, is kind of infused with the German collective memory about this, which is, of course, impacted by their history with Jewish and Israeli people. So it's very hard to find one particular source that you can say, okay, this is going to give me an objective opinion. You have to just use your own I don't want to sound like a conspiratorial because you end up just going watching YouTube and say, you know, I'm doing my own research, you know, that kind of. but just know what is the kind of agenda of all these different kind of media sources and trying to make your own interpretations and cross-referencing.
Yeah, as a media studies student, I think that's probably one of the most important things when doing research is to just keep looking at different perspectives, just keep researching, and then when that's not enough, just use a lot of critical thinking, see whether there's anything behind it, any agenda, you know, and really just get to the root of what is being said and then sort of form your own opinion on something. Thank you a lot, Dr. Leon. We really appreciate you coming here.
Thanks very much. Yeah, no, thanks for having me.
R1 News at 1.
That was Tristan Serrano's interview with Dr. Leon Goldsmith from Otako Whakaihu Walker's politics department on the ongoing conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. I'm the news producer, Jemima Lorimer, taking over the show. Next up, we have Jordan Irvine from Critic Te Arohi and from Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi, of course, joining us to talk about this week's local produce featured artist. But first up, this is M with The Love and the Fight on Radio 1.
Local produce, but the Radio 1 version. It's like normal local produce, but for the radio. We invite Critic Te Arohi's local produce columnist, Jordan Irvine, on air to talk about this week's featured artist or initiative on the R1 News.
Kia ora, Jordan. Welcome.
Kia ora. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming on to the R1 News at 1. So, this week's local produce. Sick boy. Oh, wow. Okay.
What is going on? I don't know. Sick boy. Dunedin rapper, which is an odd sentence sometimes to say. I went to high school with a couple of rappers. They weren't very good. I think one of them still makes a song every now and then, and the other guy deleted all his music like it's erased. But Sick Boy has been putting out music since like 2019.
Wow, that's quite a wee while.
Yeah, it's still going. Just released an EP a couple of weeks ago, so yeah.
Awesome. So that EP is called The Tale of Tim Branson.
Yeah.
The Tale of Tim Branson. Who is Tim Branson?
I think it's just like a character he and his producers, Will and Cameron, have made up. And, like, there's, like, a loose kind of narrative plot throughout the EP. All the tracks kind of, like, blend into each other. And they know, like, the story, kind of. But for the listener, you kind of have to, like, find it your own way. Which I think is, like, kind of cool. That's not super explicit kind of thing. You just have a little listen.
I love that. Yes, I love the quote here that says... not the quote itself, but I love how they're talking about how they kind of keep themselves at a distance from their music and let people to relate to it in their own way and figure it out for themselves.
Yeah, because I feel like, especially in hip-hop, since it is so, like, word-heavy, there often isn't, like, a lot of room for, like, misinterpretation a lot of the time because everything is just so laid out. It's not as, like, abstract as general, like, alternative songwriting. So the ability to still kind of like find that balance, I think, is really impressive.
Indeed. You're a big fan of the rap genre, I know that.
Yeah, I'm a big nerd.
Don't be so mean to yourself. but for, you know, what rappers out there would like Sick... I mean, if you're a fan of like these rappers... I'm being really theoretical right now, but if you like these rappers, like, Would you like sick boy? Okay. You know, do you know what I'm trying
yeah.
to say?
Okay, so if you're a fan of blank rapper, you may like sick boy.
That's it. That's exactly what I'm saying.
And blank rappers would be, as he mentions, Tom Scott of Homebrew, Avondale Bowling Club, Average Rap Band, At Peace, etc., etc. New Zealand hip hop artist. Yeah, he's like the best to do it. Very jazzy. And yeah, has really nice flows. I think that's like the main one you want to go to. I think someone like Mike, just Mike, M-I-K-E, all caps. Another very jazzy kind of rapper that can keep it pretty abstract at times. Who else is there? He mentions Joey Badass, so I'd also throw in MF Doom, since he's heavily inspired. Joey Badass, a lot of lyrical kind of guys, if that's more kind of your thing. Like, there is like a lot of melody in a lot of the tracks Sick Boy makes, but there is like heavy emphasis on the lyrical, but not too much like lyrical miracle like your Eminems and other white rappers that suck. Yeah.
And do you want to tell us about the special choice of font going on in this local
project? I managed to convince Evie to find out what the font used for the headings for the movie Trainspotting was. It's just Helvetica. And I even made Evie do it orange as well, because the name Sick Boy does come from the character from the film, as well as the book Trainspotting, written by Irvin Welsh. The person who directed it is escaping me. Sick Boy is played by Johnny Lee Miller, who also played Sherlock Holmes in Elementary, among other roles. Yeah, he just really was attached to the character, which I think is quite cool, and chose that name. And yeah, I love Trainspotting. That's probably one of my favourite movies of all time as well. And the book's really good. I love anything Irvin Welsh writes. Yeah.
Such a great film. Yes. Okay, so if you want to find out more about Sick Boy, you can find them on Instagram at SickBoyXO. And they have a new EP up, all available on all streaming services. So they're on Spotify. They're on it all.
Yeah, so go give it a listen if you like some jazzy rap kind of stuff.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Jordan.
No, thank you for having me. It's very cool because, like, this was your column, and now it's my column, and it's like, ah.
Yeah. Yeah, truly. Okay, next up for you, this is Sick Boy with Tim Branson on R1 News.
Game of the 1942 World Series broadcast is coming to you from Sportsman's Park in St. Louis. We're waiting for Red Rock.
You've been listening to R1 News at 1, here on Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi. The R1 News is uploaded daily wherever you get your podcasts, or head to r1.co.nz/news to get yourself all caught up. Additionally, you can follow R1 News NZ to keep up to date with all our newsworthy happenings.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.